This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. This is chapter 65. In that monthly periodical, I was able to publish for the first time the material that became the foundation for anthroposophic activity. Published there for the first time was what I had to say about the inner effort needed to attain suprasensory knowledge through one's own inner perception. I wrote monthly installments of titled How to Know Higher Worlds, unquote. I also wrote a series of articles called, quote, Out of the Akashic Record, unquote, the basis for my anthroposophic cosmology. The anthroposophic movement grew from this foundation, not from anything borrowed from the Theosophical Society. When I wrote on spiritual knowledge, if I considered what was generally taught in the society, it was simply to present correctly what seemed to me to be errors in that teaching. In relation to this, I must discuss an issue that is always raised by opponents, usually those fogged by misunderstandings. Inner reasons would not require me to speak of this, because it has no influence at all on my path of development or on my public activities. It has remained entirely private in contrast to much of what I have described here. It is the matter of my acceptance into the esoteric school of the Theosophical Society. The esoteric school dated back to H.P. Blavatsky. Within the society she instituted a small inner circle in which she communicated matters she did not wish to speak of to the general society. Like others with insight into the spirit world, she maintained that it was impossible to impart certain more profound teachings to the general public. All this was connected with how H.P. Blavatsky attained her teachings. There has always been a tradition concerning such teachings that goes back to the ancient mystery schools. This tradition is nurtured in all kinds of societies that strictly guard the teaching from reaching the outside world. However, from some source, it was deemed proper to impart such knowledge to H.P. Blavatsky. She combined what she attained in this way with revelations that arose within herself. She was an individual with peculiar atavistic powers. Spirit worked through her in a dreamlike state of consciousness, just as in ancient times it had acted through leaders of the mysteries, unlike our modern consciousness, which is illumined by the consciousness soul. Thus in Blavatsky, the human being, something recurred that was innate within the mysteries during primordial times. Today one can determine with certainty the spiritual perceptions that can be imparted appropriately to larger circles. Spiritual investigators can convey anything that can be clothed in ideas appropriate to the consciousness soul. In character, the kinds of ideas used in conventional science. It is different, however, when spiritual knowledge is not alive in the consciousness soul, but lives more in subconscious soul forces. Those soul forces are not sufficiently independent of the body's active forces. Consequently, it may be dangerous to communicate teachings derived from such subconscious regions. Such teachings can be taken in again only by those subconscious regions. Consequently, both teacher and student move in a sphere where one must be very careful to distinguish between what is wholesome and what is harmful for a human being. This is not an issue for anthroposophy, however, because what it communicates is raised entirely into the realm of full consciousness. Blavatsky's inner circle continued as the esoteric school. Because I had introduced my anthroposophic activity into the Theosophical Society, I had to keep informed of everything taking place within the society. That is why I became a member of the esoteric school. Because I also thought that a closer circle was necessary for advanced students of anthroposophic spiritual knowledge. But the group I had in mind was intended to serve a different purpose than that of the school. It would be a higher section, a higher class, for those who had absorbed enough basic knowledge of anthroposophy. I always wanted to link whatever I did with what already existed and was present historically. I wanted to do this in the esoteric school, just as I had done in relation to the Theosophical Society. Thus my more intimate circle first arose as well in connection with the school. But the connection was related only to the external arrangements, not to the suprasensory knowledge I imparted. Thus in the early years, my smaller circle was seen as a section of Mrs. Besant's esoteric school. Yet according to its inner nature, it was completely unrelated to that school. And in 1907, when Mrs. Besant attended our Theosophical Conference in Munich, even that outer connection was severed completely by mutual agreement. There is no possibility that I received any special knowledge in Mrs. Besant's esoteric school, simply because I never participated in the school's activities, except for a few times when I merely wanted to know what was taking place. In any case, at the time the only real substance in that school came from H. P. Blavatsky, and that could be obtained in print. Also, Mrs. Besant gave various types of Indian practices for developing spiritual knowledge, which I rejected. Thus, as for the external arrangements before 1907, my restricted circle was connected with that of Mrs. Besant. Nevertheless, opponents who have made an issue out of those facts are completely wrong. Some maintained the absurd idea that I was led to spiritual insight solely through Mrs. Besant's esoteric school. In 1903, Marie von Sievers and I participated again in the London Theosophical Congress. The president of the Theosophical Society, Colonel Olcott, had returned from India. He was extremely likable. His energy and his extraordinary gift for organization made it easy to see how he came to be Blavatsky's partner in establishing, organizing, and guiding the Theosophical Society. And indeed, externally, the Society had quickly become a large, well-organized body. For a brief time, Marie von Sievers and I had closer contact with Mrs. Besant, because she lived in London with Mrs. Bright, and we were invited to stay at this friendly home during our later visits there. The household included Mrs. Bright and her daughter Esther. Both were like kindness incarnated. It gave me great joy to recall the time I was privileged to spend in their home. The Brights were devoted and loyal friends of Mrs. Besant. They worked to strengthen the bond between Mrs. Besant and us. Later on, certain things, some of which have been mentioned here, made it impossible for me to collaborate with Mrs. Besant, and this caused pain to the Brights as well. They were completely non-judgmental in their firm loyalty to the spiritual leader of the Theosophical Society. Mrs. Besant had certain qualities that to me made her an interesting person. I recognized that she had a certain right to speak of the spirit world from her own experience. She certainly had an inner ability to get through to the spiritual world. But later this was taken over by her own outer goals. I could not help finding this person interesting, one who was able to speak from the spirit about spirit. But strictly speaking, it was my view that in our time spiritual insight must live within the consciousness soul. I saw into an ancient spiritual knowledge of humanity. It had a dreamy character. People saw images that revealed the spirit world, but they did not develop those images through any clear mental intention for knowledge. Rather, they arose in the soul, provided by the cosmos like dreams. In the Middle Ages, that ancient spirit knowledge faded away when people gained the consciousness soul. The dreamy knowledge ceased. People now evoked ideas through completely clear minds, through their will to know. This ability is expressed first in terms of knowing the sensory world. In this sense, it reaches its peak in natural science. The task of spirit knowledge is to bring the experience of ideas to the spiritual world in full clarity of mind and through the will to know. The experience of cognizing such ideas is like the experience of mathematics. One thinks like a mathematician, but not in numbers or geometrical forms. One thinks in images of the spirit world. This means standing in full consciousness within the spiritual world in contrast to the awake dream experience of ancient spirit knowledge. Within the Theosophical Society, it was impossible to gain the correct relationship to this new approach to spirit knowledge. Any suggestion that spirit should be approached while fully awake and conscious was viewed with suspicion. People knew full consciousness only in relation to the sensory realm. No one could understand that fully awake consciousness can be developed to the point of experiencing spirit. On the contrary, there were attempts to return to ancient dream consciousness by suppressing awake consciousness, and this was true of Mrs. Besant as well. It was hardly possible for her to understand the modern approach to spiritual knowledge. Yet what she said about the spiritual world did come from that world. Because of this, I found her interesting. I was unable to feel at home in the Theosophical Society in relation to spiritual matters, because that same aversion to a fully conscious approach to spirit was also present in the other leaders there. Socially, it was a pleasure to move in those circles, but their sole disposition toward spirit remained alien to me. For the same reason, I was not inclined to speak from my own spiritual experience when I gave lectures at the society conferences. My lectures could have been given by someone with no spiritual perception. Those experiences immediately came to life in my lectures that took place outside the society, which were arranged by Marie von Sievers and myself from Berlin. Work began to arise in Berlin, Munich, Stuttgart, and later in other places. All that came from the Theosophical Society gradually disappeared. Anthroposophy manifested and was accepted through the power of its own inner life. I gave conceptual form to the results of my spiritual research, and, together with Marie von Sievers, arrangements were made for outer activities. Certainly, at that time, I stood fully conscious within the spirit world. But about 1902, and in relation to many events during the following years, I experienced imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions. However, these gradually came together only in my published writings. Marie von Sievers' devoted work made possible, initially on a very small scale, the Philosophical Anthroposophical Publishing Company. Our first publication was a booklet that contained notes from lectures I gave at the Berlin Independent College, which I have mentioned. Our second publication was my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, The Philosophy of Freedom. It had become necessary for us to obtain this book and distribute it ourselves, because the former publisher was no longer able to do this. We bought the remaining copies and the publication rights. This was not easy, owing to our meager financial means. Nevertheless, the work progressed, indeed precisely because it depended on nothing external, but solely on its inner connection with spirit. The end of chapter 65. Chapter 66. My first lectures within the groups that arose from the Theosophical movement had to be adjusted to the soul disposition of those people. They had assimilated Theosophic literature and were accustomed to certain modes of expression. Initially, in order to be understood, I had to remain with those modes. Nor was it possible for me to use my own terms until, over the course of time, the work had progressed. As a result, the lecture material, as it was made available through notes taken during the first years of the anthroposophic work, gives a true inner picture spiritually. It portrays the path I adopted to gradually make spiritual knowledge known, so that what was closer could lead to an understanding of what was more remote. But this approach must really be seen in light of its inner quality. For me, the period between 1901 and about 1907 or 08 was when I experienced with all the powers of soul the realities and beings that approached me from the spirit world. Specific insights developed from those more general experiences of the spirit world. Many experiences arise when writing a book like titled Theosophy. At every step, I endeavored to retain a connection with scientific thinking. This assumes particular forms as a spiritual experience deepens and broadens. In titled Theosophy, it seems as though the tone completely changes the moment I pass from describing the nature of the human being to presenting the, quote, soul world, unquote, and, quote, spirit land, unquote. In the description of human nature, I start with the results of physical science. I try to deepen anthropology so that the human organism is seen in all its differentiations. Then it is possible to see how, as a differentiated organism, it is likewise related in a differentiated way to the spiritual soul beings permeating it. Life activity is found in the organized form. One sees there the activity of the etheric body. The sensory and perceptual organs are found through the physical organism. They indicate the presence of the astral body. These members of the human being, the ether and astral bodies, the I, capital, and so on, were present to my spiritual sight. In my description, I intended to connect them with the results of physical science. It becomes difficult to remain scientific when explaining repeated earthly lives and the destiny that forms through them. If the description is to include more than what is seen spiritually, one must consider ideas that arise from closely observing the sensory world, but are not comprehended by people. Subtle observation reveals that human beings differ from animals in organization and development. When this difference is observed, the ideas of repeated earthly lives become obvious from life itself. Usually, however, one simply fails to notice it. Consequently, the ideas of repeated earthly lives do not seem to be taken from life, but rather arbitrarily thought out or merely taken from ancient worldviews. I was fully aware of such difficulties, and I struggled with them. If a person takes the trouble to follow in the successive editions of titled Theosophy, the way I continued to rewrite the chapter on repeated lives on earth, and attempted to communicate these truths and concepts taken from physical observation, one will discover my care in trying to do justice to accepted scientific method. The chapters on the soul world and spirit land were even more difficult in this sense. The truths presented in those chapters will seem like arbitrary, casual assertions to those who have merely read through the preceding descriptions. It is different, however, when one's reading of such ideas related to the sense world strengthens and enhances the life of ideas. For them, the life of ideas will become independent and loosened from bondage to the senses. Now another soul process can take place. They become aware of the independent life of the ideas set free. Those ideas actively weave in the soul, where they are experienced as one might experience color, sound, and warmth through the physical senses. Just as the natural world is presented to us through colors, sounds, and so on, the world of spirit is presented through consciously experienced ideas. But when the first part of title, Theosophy, is read without aware inner experience, and with no awareness of a transformation in one's experience of ideas, one will read the second part as though beginning with the chapter on the soul world. As a result, one could only reject what is presented. The truths presented will seem like unproven assertions. An anthroposophic book, however, is meant to be received into inner experience. This leads to the gradual awakening of a certain understanding. This may be a very faint inner experience, but it can indeed should occur. And the strengthened depth gained through the exercises described in title How to Know Higher Worlds is just that, a fortifying deepening. This is necessary for progress on the spiritual path, but a properly written anthroposophic book should awaken the spiritual life of the reader and not merely be a collection of information. Reading it should be more than reading. It should be an experience accompanied by inner shocks, tensions, and resolutions. I realize how far the substance and inner power of my books are from always invoking such an experience in the soul of the reader. But I also know that my inner struggle over every page was to attain as much as possible in this way. I do not adopt a style that allows subjective feelings to be detached in the sentences. In writing, I subdue what comes from warmth and deeper feelings to a dry, mathematical style. This style alone can be an awakener, for the readers themselves must awaken inner warmth and feeling. They cannot let those feelings simply flow into them from a description while their attentiveness remains passive. Artistic interests were barely cultivated at all within the Theosophical Society. From a certain perspective, this was completely understandable. But this had to change before a proper spiritual attitude could thrive. Members of such a society tend to focus all their interests primarily on the reality of spiritual life. In the sensory world, the human being appears to them as merely a transitory existence, severed from spirit. Artistic activity seems to exist within that severed existence. Thus, it seems to be outside of the spiritual reality that is sought. Because of this, artists did not feel at home in the Theosophical Society. It was important to Marie von Sievers and to me that the arts should come to life within the society. Consequently, spirit knowledge indeed takes in the whole of human existence. All the soul forces are stimulated. The light from inner spiritual experience shines into the creating imagination. But here something enters that creates hindrances. Artists have some anxiety about their imagination being illumined by the world of spirit. They prefer to remain unaware of the exercise of the soul world, and this feeling is appropriate when it is a matter of the imagination being stimulated by the conscious thought element that has dominated culture since the beginning of the era of consciousness soul. This stimulation through human intellectuality has a deadening effect on art. Just the opposite occurs, however, when directly perceived spiritual meaning fills the imagination with light. All the creative powers that have ever led to art among humanity are resurrected in this way. Marie von Sievers was truly accomplished in the art of speech formation and greatly gifted in dramatic art. A sphere of art was thus present within the anthroposophic activity, and based on this we could test the fertility of spiritual perception for art. The evolution of the consciousness soul exposes the quote-unquote word to danger from two directions. Speech serves as mediator in society, and it communicates logical, intellectual knowledge. In both directions, the word loses its inherent value. It must adapt to the meaning of what it is intended to express. It must allow ignorance of the fact that the sound, tone, and formation of tone itself contain a reality. The beauty, the shining of the vowel, and the character of the consonant is lost in speech. The vowel loses its soul, and the consonant becomes void of spirit. Speech entirely vacates the realm from which it originates, spirit. It becomes the servant of intellectual knowledge, and serves a society that flees spirit. It is torn completely from the realm of art. True spiritual perception enters the, quote, experience of word, unquote, as if by instinct. It learns to feel its way into the vowel's reverberation, sustained by the soul, and into the consonant's painting, energized by spirit. Gradually it begins to understand the mysterious evolution of speech, the mystery that at one time divine spiritual beings were able to speak to the human soul through the word, whereas now it is merely a means of communication in the physical world. One needs enthusiasm kindled by this spiritual insight to lead the word back to its own sphere. Marie von Sievers developed such enthusiasm. Thus she brought to the anthroposophic movement the possibility of artistically cultivating speech and speech formation. In this way, the cultivation of recitation and declamation as an art was added to the activity of communicating spiritual knowledge, and this played an increasing role in anthroposophic events. Marie von Sievers' recitations at those events were the beginning of the impact of art on the anthroposophic movement. The dramatic performances that later took place in Munich, along with the anthroposophic courses developed directly from those recitations, initially given to supplement the lectures. Because we could develop art through spiritual knowledge, we increasingly penetrated the truth of modern spiritual experience. Art originally grew out of dreamy, pictorial experiences of spirit. As this spirit experience receded in the course of human evolution, art had to find its way alone. It must find its way again to a unity with spiritual experience, when in a new form this experience becomes part of human cultural development. The end of chapter 66. Chapter 67. I began the anthroposophic work just when many people were beginning to feel dissatisfied with the trend of thinking in recent years. They wanted to escape their restricted field of knowledge, which was imposed on them because they considered knowledge unreliable if it could not be grasped with mechanistic ideas. I was deeply affected by the fact that many of my contemporaries endeavored to discover some form of spiritual insight. Biologists such as Oscar Hertwig, who had been a student of Haeckel but abandoned Darwin, seemed to express the longing of that time, feeling that spiritual knowledge offered no real explanation of organic development. I sensed, however, that a burden weighed on this longing as a result of the belief that one could obtain real knowledge only from what is measurable, quantifiable, and subject to gravity, that is, only from the phenomena that can be investigated by the physical senses. One would not dare to develop inwardly active thinking, and through the power of thinking, experience reality in a far more direct way than is possible through the senses. Rather, it was stated simply that further insight was impossible using the means employed so far to explain even the higher forms of existence, such as the organic world. So at the very point where there should have been a positive achievement, insight into the manifestation of life process, only vague ideas emerged. For the most part, those who tried to go beyond explanations of the universe in terms of mechanics lacked the courage to admit that the ingrained thinking leading to those explanations must also be overcome. At the time, there was an unwillingness to admit that an orientation based only on the senses comprehends only what is mechanistic. People had grown accustomed to this orientation by the second half of the 19th century. Today, however, we have reached the point where a mechanistic explanation proves unsatisfactory, and we should not simply go on to investigate higher forms of existence with the same orientation. The human physical senses develop on their own, but they develop only the means to perceive the mechanistic world. If we wish to know more, we will have to develop deeper forces of knowledge, just as nature developed physical forces. The cognitive forces needed to comprehend mechanical manifestations awaken on their own. The forces needed to grasp higher forms of existence must be awakened. It seemed to me that such an admission on the part of the search for knowledge was a necessity of the time. Even a trace of such recognition made me happy. I recall with great pleasure a visit to Jena. I had to present lectures in Weimar on anthroposophic themes, and a lecture had been arranged as well for a small group in Jena. After the lecture, a few people gathered socially. People wanted to debate about what theosophy had to say. Max Scheler was among them. He lectured on philosophy at that time at the University of Jena. The discussion soon turned to his reaction to my lectures. I immediately felt the deep character in his search for knowledge. He brought an inner tolerance to my views, a tolerance necessary for those who truly search for knowledge. We discussed the epistemological justification of spiritual cognition. We spoke of the problem of establishing an epistemology for penetrating spiritual reality, just as one does sensory reality. Scheller's thinking impressed me as very brilliant. To this day I follow the development of his thinking with deep interest. I experienced heartfelt satisfaction on the far too few occasions when I have met this man who was so congenial to me. Experiences of this kind were important to me. They caused me to test repeatedly the certainty of my own path to knowledge. Such continually recurring tests also developed the forces that opened further and further realms of spiritual existence. The two results of my anthroposophic efforts are, first, the books made available to the general public, and second, a great number of lecture courses originally intended to be privately published and sold only to members of the Theosophical, later Anthroposophical, Society. Those courses consist of more or less accurate notes taken at my lectures, which I have not had time to correct. I would have preferred the spoken word to remain the spoken word, but the members wanted the courses printed for private circulation. Thus they came into existence. If the time had been available to correct them, the restriction for members only would have been unnecessary from the beginning. As it is, the restriction was dropped more than a year ago. It is especially necessary in my autobiography to say something about how my books for the general public, on the one hand, and the privately printed courses on the other, form a part of the anthroposophy I developed. Anyone who wishes to trace my inner struggle and effort to present anthroposophy for today's mode of consciousness must do so through the writings published for general distribution. There I define my position in relation to the current search for knowledge. They contain the structure of anthroposophy, which, to my spiritual sight, became more and more clearly defined, though certainly incomplete in many ways. Aside from the demand of building up anthroposophy and devoting myself solely to the results of imparting truths directly from the spiritual world to today's general culture, the demand also arose to meet fully the soul need and spiritual longing of the members. And there was an especially strong inclination for anthroposophy to shed light on the Gospels and the Bible as a whole. The members wanted lecture courses on the revelations given to humankind. In meeting this need through private lecture courses, another aspect arose. These lectures were attended by members only, who were familiar with basic content of anthroposophy. I could address them as people who were advanced in the area of anthroposophy. The approach I adopted in these lectures was not at all suitable for the written works, which were intended primarily for the general public. In the private groups, I was able to formulate what I had to say in a way that would have had to be modified if originally it had been planned for the general public. Thus, the public and the private publications are in fact very different and built on different foundations. The written work for the public is the result of my own inner struggles and labors, whereas the privately printed material is the result of a joint struggle and labor with the society. I listened to what reverberated in the soul life of the members, and the perspective of each lecture arose in my living experience of what I heard. However, all that was said was the purest result of the growing content of anthroposophy. There was never any question of bowing to the members' prejudices or preferences. Those who read those privately printed lectures can assume that they represent the message of anthroposophy in the fullest sense. Consequently, when complaints became too persistent, there was no need to hesitate in abandoning the rule of circulating the material only among members. But it must be accepted that since I did not personally revise those reports of lectures, there are faulty passages in them. The right to judge that private material can, of course, be granted only to those who have the prerequisite foundation for such judgment, and in terms of most of that material, this would mean at least knowing the human being and the cosmos as they have been presented in the light of anthroposophy. It would also include knowing what exists as anthroposophic history in what was given from the spiritual world. The end of chapter 67 and the end of this section of the reading.